honor to be with you here. I'm actually up in the Denver area, leaving. I'm actually going to be here Sunday morning. Is that okay to tell everybody that? Oh, okay. Didn't know if that was. But I'll be speaking here Sunday morning and then going straight down to Santa Fe and then home after that. I'm home 9 days before I go to South Africa. And I will be doing a debate with Graham Codrington on gay marriage down there if the government doesn't get involved. Prayers appreciated for that. I'm up here, as he said, riding. Yesterday, I climbed from Summit Lake to the top of Mount Evans. That was an experience, since I'm terrified of heights. If you've ever done that climb, then you know that was a victory for me, that I didn't end up just plastered to a rock someplace going, help, call a helicopter, I'm dead. I did have to get out of the way of a male mountain goat, who was coming down the other direction. I'm like, I'm right away to the natural wildlife, I'm out of here. I've been speaking in a number of churches up here. I've been speaking almost every night this week, actually. And so I only have a few minutes and a lot to cover. My assumption was that if we're talking about going out and doing evangelism, that the focus would be upon the reality that one of the most common objections that is going to be presented to us is that no matter what we say, we eventually will be defaulting back to the subject of the Scriptures. And while my grandparents and great-grandparents did not have to spend much time defending the veracity of the Scriptures, because there was a general cultural awareness and acceptance of the authority of Scripture, that's now the opposite, in essence. And the objections to the nature of Scripture can come from many different perspectives. There can be philosophical argumentation. There's all sorts of types of objections. But the one area of objection that most Christians feel extremely troubled by and want to try to avoid is the one area that I've been spending a lot of my life trying to help people out with, and that is, how can we know that what we read in our Bibles today actually goes back to the apostles themselves? Now, a lot of the other talks will probably be touching upon some of the apologetic issues regarding the ultimate authority of Scripture, God being a God who can communicate. Is that something that's even rational to believe today? So on and so forth. But in the brief period of time that I have, the thing that I think I can do the most good in would be to assist you in having confidence in that particular issue. And I want to start sort of backwards today, and that is, I want to start with something incredibly complicated and try to move away from there. I figure we tried to plug my iPad in, and the system said, no, I'm not talking to that Apple stuff. So evidently, Bill Gates has taken over your system somehow, and you're stuck with that. But I feel sorry for you whenever you have to do an update. We'll see you in a few weeks. We tried to plug in. So I wasn't going to try to compete with Jason Lyle when it comes to tech and graphics and stuff like that, because I'm just sort of like, yeah, well, whatever. I know when I'm outclassed, and I'm not even going to try. So what I did do, though, is I pulled up we're actually close enough to each other here that I can hold my iPad up, and you'll actually be able to see something. I pulled up. It's available. One of the nice things about this is this information is available to anyone who wants to access it. One of the nice things that I like to point out when I'm, for example, doing debates with Muslims, I'll be doing two debates in South Africa later this month with Muslims, is that when we talk about the New Testament, and I'm focusing primarily upon the New Testament, the vast majority of the argumentation is about New Testament texts and things like that. A lot of what I will say would be applicable to the Old Testament, but the Old Testament is considerably older and has a different history of transmission. The Old Testament text was primarily transmitted covenantally amongst the people of God for the vast majority of its history, because it was the covenant documents of the people of God. You didn't have Israel trying specifically There was no Israeli Bible Society trying to get copies of the Torah out to the Babylonians or the Egyptians or something like that. The text was primarily for the people of God, and so it has a unique transmission history to it. But the New Testament is quite different. As soon as the New Testament comes into existence, even in the New Testament itself, you see, for example, Paul saying to the Colossians in Colossians 4:16, read the epistle that's coming from Laodicea. Now, how many of you did your devotions this morning in Laodiceans? You started to put your hand up. That was a little quick. You're the guy in class that wanted to be the first. Oh, me. You know, that'll get you in trouble because no one was doing their study in Laodiceans this morning unless you did your studies in the book of Ephesians. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, it seems fairly clear to me that what Paul was intending. Are we expecting me to start crying during all of this, or just what? I'm not really sure. Maybe I'm going to put that down there. A revival is going to break out, and he's the first one that's going to hit. So it seems fairly clear to me that Ephesians was meant to be a circular letter. That means it was meant to be distributed around the churches in the Lycus River Valley. One of the obvious reasons for that is that Paul spent years in Ephesus, but there are no personal greetings in that letter. Ever found that to be odd? There's lots of personal greetings in other letters, but when it comes to that one letter where he spent so much time, invested so much of himself, no personal greetings. And there's even textual reasons for suggesting that what was intended is it would start there in the major church in Ephesus and it would be distributed amongst the churches. And so they would make a copy. So the letter would come, they'd make a copy of that letter and then send the letter on to the next church. And so the Colossians were to read the epistle that was coming from the Laodiceans, which was probably the book of Ephesians. And so even in the New Testament, we have evidence of the fact that immediately the desire was to get the message out, get the word out as widely as possible. Well, that introduces all sorts of questions, because if this is being done in a handwritten method, there was no printing. That's the middle of the 15th century. There was no photocopying. That's 1949. And so there has to be another way of distributing the word of God and these epistles from the apostles that would eventually come together to be our New Testament. Now, there's entire discussions of why we only have 27 books in the New Testament, why we don't have the apocryphal books in the Old Testament. The issue of the canon is a very relevant issue. I would highly recommend to you minimally taking the time to look up a discussion that I had with Dr. Michael Kruger at the G3 conference 2 years ago, I think. We only had an hour, but we discussed the issue of the canon, some of the most basic theological, doctrinal foundations that we need to understand in that area, too. And it is a related area. It's an important area beyond the amount of time that we have this afternoon. But it is one that I would recommend Dr. Kruger's works on. And that discussion would be a nice way to sort of, you know, summarize that and give you an idea if you want to then go buy the books and do the deeper study. But the 27 books of the New Testament, the core of our theological message, for example, I just mentioned the debate that I'll be doing down in South Africa. I know that my opponent well knows that Matthew chapter 19 exists, and that in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus quotes from the law, he quotes from the Pentateuch, he quotes from the creation narrative, and he makes that normative. He holds men accountable to that, and he bases his answer regarding divorce on creation parameters laid down in writings that were written long, long, long before that day. And so how do we know that that's what Matthew actually wrote? How do we know that Mark, when he's writing a parallel to something in Matthew, that we have what Mark wrote? Because any one of us, and you'll encounter people in the park, you'll encounter people in your lives who are well aware of the fact that there are those little notes down the bottom of the page, either in your Bible, in your printed edition. And one of the problems is a lot of us are no longer using printed editions. And there might be that tiny, tiny little letter, or maybe you even turn them off in your electronic version on your phone or whatever else. But they might not be on the screen. You may not even see that there are notifications within the text when there are textual variants. We have approximately 5,800 Greek manuscripts containing portions of the New Testament. Many of the older ones contain all the New Testament. But when you use that number, 5,800, remember, that's not from Matthew to Revelation. We have just massive amount of information. No other work of antiquity comes even close to not only the amount of information we have, not only Greek, but Latin, Sahidic, Boharic, all sorts of other early translations of the New Testament. No other work of antiquity even comes close to not only how many manuscripts we have, but how early they go. That's actually been a problem because we have so much. When we talk to people who study Plato or other contemporary writers back in that time period, they look at us to study the New Testament like, what are you people complaining about? On average, for the people who would be studying Pliny, Suetonius, some of the Greek historians and things like that, the time period between when their guy was writing and the first copy that you would have of his writings is between 500 and 900 years. Between 500 and 900 years between when the guy lived and wrote and the first manuscript copy we have. And for some of them, we might have 7, 8 manuscripts grand total, separated in time from the author by often over 1,000 years. And so they look at us, and we have 5,800 manuscripts. We have hundreds of them that come within the first few centuries. Now, the vast majority come 1,000 years later. There's no question about that. But we have manuscripts. We have little portions of, for example, the Gospel of John that go back to about 125 A.D. So within 50-some-odd years, depending on where you place John's writing and when John was written, and that in and of itself is a fascinating conversation that we could have at some point in time. So we have far earlier attestation for the New Testament than any other work of antiquity. But because there are so many manuscripts, no human mind can keep, well, maybe Jason could, but he hasn't bothered to get around to this yet. But nobody else would be is able to keep track of all of the variant readings in each manuscript so as to start seeing the relationship between manuscripts. And so what has developed, you right now are living in the middle of a revolution that you don't know about. You don't know about it. Well, a couple of you that maybe have been to G3 know about it. But, for example, how many of you have an ESV? Okay. All right. Large. Best marketed modern translation done in English. No question about it. And if you have an older ESV, I can show you where it's different from a newer edition of the ESV. And it's an important text. It's in the little book of Jude, verse 5. Notice I didn't give you a chapter because there's only one of them, so you don't have to worry about that. Jude 5, if you have a New American Standard, if you have the New King James or the King James, it will say that the Lord delivered a people out of Egypt. And that's what most of us are accustomed to in that text. But if you look at the modern edition of the ESV, it says Jesus delivered a people out of Egypt. Now you might say, well, the Lord Jesus, isn't that the same thing? Well, think about it. The term Lord is normally what is used when the Old Testament was talking about Yahweh, Jehovah. And that would be the normal terminology that would be used of God's activities in the Old Testament. It would be the Lord did this, the Lord preserved a people for himself, etc., etc. If you say Jesus delivered a people out of Egypt, you're making a specific Christological statement about who Jesus is, that he is God. He is Yahweh. So if the ESV now says Jesus, but at first it said Lord, why? Well, I'll show you why. I'm going to hold it up. I wish I could put it on a screen, but you can see the complexity of it. That's why. And you're going, that looks like something Jason would write. Right? This is called CBGM. And in fact, let me scroll down here. There's the relationship of the various manuscripts related to one another as far as what's called genealogical coherence. This is not a Jude 5. This is specifically in Acts chapter 5. Looks a little complicated, doesn't it? Well, it is. And I can tap on any one of those manuscripts, and what will come up will be a box that will tell me. It's 10 closest relatives, the amount of coherence between those manuscripts. I can expand that out to a larger number of manuscripts. Huge amount of data that we have finally been able to take all these manuscripts and their variant readings and everything and put them into a massive, giant database, which our brains just simply can't handle, and said, okay, Mr. Computer, I want to know who's related to whom. Now, this is a controversial thing. Basically, to make a long story short, if you're wondering about Jude 5, the reason that the ESV reads the way it is because the Greek New Testament that it's translating, called the Nestle-Aland 28th edition, adopted that reading as its main text. Now, in any Nestle-Aland, UBS, you have a text reading, and then down below, you have the variants. And we've known that there were manuscripts that said Jesus for hundreds and hundreds, thousands, well, probably since back in the early church. So it's not that this was like, oh, we've discovered a new papyrus and no one ever seen this before. No, that almost never happens. Why then did the Nestle-Aland text adopt this? Well, because the people who work on this stuff in a place called Münster in Germany, that's where all this data is gathered together in one place. They analyzed using what's called CBGM, coherence-based genealogical method. This is the revolution that's going on. They analyzed all the manuscripts that said Lord, and they looked at all the manuscripts that said Jesus. And my iPod is on the floor under your foot there, so we don't want that to happen. There we go. And they looked at all the manuscripts that said Jesus. And when you look at all the manuscripts that say Jesus, their closest relative also says Jesus. But over here on the Lord's side, their closest relatives would normally say Jesus rather than Lord. There is no coherence here, which means there is a disruption in the reading of the text over time. And it makes sense because it would be more natural for a scribe to say the Lord delivered the people out of Egypt than to say Jesus delivered the people out of Egypt. That would be that's an unusual statement. And so the manuscripts reflect that there is greater coherence amongst those that say Jesus. And so because of that, in the current edition of the Nestle-Aland text, Jesus is the main text, and so the ESV is just simply following that. It's not like they made this up. They're simply following that text. Now, so far, only the general epistles and Acts have been worked on in this way. Mark's about to come out, and that's when you're going to hear about CBGM. You got to hear about it first. You're going to be ahead of the curve. And the problem is not too many people even understand what CBGM is. I taught at a major seminary a year and a half ago. Well, 2 years ago, I taught at a major seminary. And nobody that I talked to in the New Testament department had ever heard of CBGM. So unfortunately, what's going to happen is CNN and those guys are going to pick it up first. And they're going to twist it all into a pretzel. And then we'll eventually get around to fixing this stuff. Now, why do I give you all that stuff? It's real simple. What's really neat is because of this now, for years we've had sort of general numbers floating around. How accurate is the text? What percentage of the text is really in dispute and in doubt? And you'll have one scholar say this, another scholar say that. And the numbers have normally been between like 0.5% and maybe 4%, something like, depending on who you were talking to. Well, once you start cramming everything into the computer tends to be really like accurate, like Mr. Spock, you know, or Mr. Data, you know. Could you round that off with Mr. Data, please, just a little bit, you know. Computers tend to be that way. And so what we can now document with computer-level accuracy is that the accusation that the New Testament texts are just all over the place and they're all at variance with one another, so on and so forth, is completely untrue. In fact, the numbers you can pull up from the CBGM module, and this is available online to anyone who knows where to find it and what to do with it. It's not hidden away like that. the numbers that come up that, like, let's say I just I tap on Codex Sinaiticus here, and when it will show the relationship between, it's actually Codex Vaticanus and Papyrus 74. And there's a percentage that says 92.5% afterwards. The temptation is to think, oh, they read 92.5% identical with one another. That's not what that number is. That's the number where in the variance they agree with one another. What CBGM has documented beyond all question is that when you're talking about the vast majority of the text, all the manuscripts are going to be agreeing about 99.5% of the time. So you have a very small number. What is the point there? The point is that there are a lot of people, my Muslim friends would like to tell us, that sometime after Jesus, somebody came along and inserted a bunch of doctrine in the New Testament about Jesus being the Son of God and resurrection from the dead and the cross and all the rest of this stuff. Well, what would happen if you had a document that was already being copied? Ephesians, hey, make a copy when it comes to you and send it on to the next church. So in other words, there's already copies being made that are then being copied. And so the transmission process has already started, and there's many lines. It's not just one line. It's not just there was one copy that was then copied, that was then copied, then it was then copied. No, that's not how it worked. Not only would there be times you'd have more than one copy that you're copying from, but people would pass these things along. And you'd come into a church in the early days, and they'd bring out a manuscript to read. And you're like, I've never heard of that. What is this? Oh, this is what we call today manuscript. This didn't have these names back then. We call it manuscript P72. It's the earliest manuscript we have of 1st, 2nd Peter and Jude. And you might be in a church, you go, we don't have that in my church. We haven't, because it's not like they had FedEx. It's not like they had the internet. You couldn't scan it with your phone and send it off to your friends or anything like that. It took time. And in fact, some books, now I don't want to offend anybody here, but especially if you're a real fan of certain very popular books on eschatology. But the one book that we have the fewest manuscripts of is, guess what? Revelation. And the reason we have the fewest manuscripts of Revelation is because there were certain portions of the Roman Empire where it was not popular at all. It had to fight for inclusion in the canon, and that's actually a good thing. That's not a bad thing. The fact that the church was exercising discernment and asking serious questions, is this really apostolic? What is the meaning of these things? That's a very, very good thing. And so we have the fewest number of manuscripts of that particular book of Revelation. And so there are going to be people that are going to, you know, raise these questions. And now we can bring all this data together and we can demonstrate that in reality, if you had all those different changes, if someone starts trying to change a line over here, let's say you get a manuscript and you make a copy of it, but you insert a bunch of stuff into it. You make a bunch of changes into it. And then that gets copied. Well, what's going to happen? Those manuscripts are going to look a whole lot different than all the other manuscripts that are still being copied over here. And you can't run over there. There's no way you can track them down. You can't track down, you know, it's sort of like the Da Vinci Code. You know, Emperor Constantine gathered up all the copies of the Gospels and rewrote them and made new ones. Impossible. Couldn't have been done. Many of them were already buried in the sands of Egypt. How in the world are you supposed to get them? So if there was that kind of editing and changing, which is so often alleged today, then those manuscripts would stand out like a sore thumb, and you would not have 99.5% unanimity in handwritten documents written over a tremendous number of centuries. It just simply wouldn't happen. And even the leading critics of New Testament Christianity, like Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman will admit, we know what the New Testament was about. We're just fiddling around with some of the details. We know what the story was. There wasn't some type of massive changes. There have been some important ones, but I remember hearing him on an atheist webcast once, and he was talking about these variants and stuff like that. And the atheist finally goes, well, Dr. Ehrman, in light of all this, tell us, what do you think? What was the New Testament originally about? And you can just tell, Ehrman sort of goes, it was about Jesus as the Lamb of God that dies for the sins of the world and is raised again the third day. And the atheist is sort of like a, you know, the, you know, like you pop a balloon, and he was just so bummed. He thought it might have been about space gods or something like that, you know. And instead, you know, Ehrman's saying, no, we know what it was about. Yeah, we get it. But today we have even greater evidence than we've ever had before of that coherence of the manuscripts together and presenting the same message. And so this is rather exciting when you're debating Muslims and Surah 5 tells the Allah al-Injil, the people of the gospel, to judge by what's contained therein in the gospel itself. And we can say, hey, we've got incredibly strong evidence. We know what that gospel is, and it's not what Muhammad thought it was. So who are you going to believe? Muhammad in Surah 5 or Muhammad in Surah 3? You've got an internal contradiction in your own book because your author didn't know the Christian scriptures directly, and he didn't. So that's a rather important thing. And not when the New Agers coming along and saying, and you might run into some of them in Colorado, I'm not going to go there. And so you've all heard all the jokes about everything going on in Colorado. But anyways, when you're talking to a New Ager and the New Ager is telling you, well, the Bible used to have reincarnation in it, and then they took it out at the Council of Constantinople, and there's probably not too many people in this room that can tell you much about the Council of Constantinople. That sort of ends the conversation. The reality is that kind of accusation is pure bunk. And it can be demonstrated on the level of legal evidence in a courtroom, given how much documentation we have, that that type of accusation is bunk. And yet, that's not going to keep the Mormon missionaries. That's not going to keep the Muslims. That's not going to keep the Black Hebrew Israelites from making accusations. But we need to be the people that have the solid foundation to be able to go back and to explain to them what that's all about. So it's very important for us to recognize that that New Testament that we have has a history. You can't hide from those footnotes. There are important variants, and you need to know which ones they are so you don't get tripped up by them. I mean, you really can, in a fairly short period of time, cover a large portion of the most important variants. Now, a textual scholar would tell you that all variants are sort of equally important, in the sense that some are very complex or some are very difficult. But a lot of the variants do not even impact the meaning of the text. They do not, it would not change how you would translate it, whether you went with one variant or another. It comes into English saying the same thing. So a lot of those don't matter. But especially when we're talking to people from other religious perspectives, that's when you will encounter certain verses and certain variants that are very, very important. Now, one thing to keep in mind, I know most of you know all these things, but not everybody always does, so I want to start from the ground up. We saw most of you had the ESV. Any NASB? Okay, good, all right. Holman came out with the Holman Christian, is now just a Christian Standard Bible or something like that. Anybody got a CSB now? That's sort of, okay, all right, got one, all right. Okay, how about King James and New King James? Okay, where are our old folks? Okay, oh, sorry. all right. Now, what you need to understand is that the King James and the New King James are going to be unique amongst the Bibles as to the Greek text they are translating. Now, as far as the Old Testament text goes, I think there's a whopping 8 differences between the 1525 Bomberg text that the King James translated and the current modern, what's called the Biblia-Hebraica Septuagintia. Very, very few differences. It's almost the identical same text. But King James was based upon a text that anachronistically we call the Textus Receptus, which was an advertising blurb in 1633. The Elsevier brothers had come up with their own version of this. They were selling it, and they called it, back then, you advertised in Latin. Cool. Wouldn't work well today, but the educational system was a little better back then, and so you could read Latin, and so you'd advertise in Latin, and it's the received text. Now, no one voted on it or anything else. It was just simply the text that had been primarily brought through a man by the name of Erasmus, Desiderius Erasmus, the great Dutch humanist scholar, who died in 1535. You've got Robert Estienne, also known as Stephanus, who was Calvin's printer in Geneva, who also introduced the verse divisions in the New Testament. So if you've ever thought verse divisions are terrible, horrible things, now you know who to blame. Robert Estienne, he was actually a really nice guy, but anyway. And then you have Theodore Beza, Calvin's successor in Geneva. They all produced editions of the Greek New Testament that when the King James was translated, they used those printed editions of the Greek New Testament. Okay, so when the Elsevier brothers put together that, they drew from various and sundry sources, and that's what's called the Textus Receptus. And so when the new King James was done, they decided to continue to use the same Greek text. That was a very controversial decision, but that's what they decided to do. And so our modern translations are based upon the Nestle-Aland text, really technically now what's called the ECM, the Editio Critica Major, but anyways, as it's seen in the Nestle-Aland text. And while the TR is a venerable text, it was based on grand total. If you try to expand the numbers as much as you want, it was based on about 25 manuscripts. We have 5,800 manuscripts today. And the oldest manuscripts that had major impact upon the TR were from about 1,000 years after Christ, and the ones that had the biggest impact were written in about the 14th century. So we have fragments now. We have papyri like P66, P75, that go back to the 2nd century. So we have a much earlier witness now than was available at that particular point in time. And so many of the differences that you will see, and this is important, especially if you're talking with Mormons, because the Mormons will normally have the King James, even though, folks, Mormonism is changing. I just found out there is now a Mormon translation in the New Testament. I just had it ordered in. I'll see it when I get back to Phoenix. Man, Mormonism is changing, and it's eventually just going to go poof. You're going to see some splits in the future. But anyways, if you're talking to them, they're going to be using the King James, and they're going to raise these issues of variance. And much of it has to do between the difference between the modern critical text that underlies all the modern translations and the King James, New King James utilization of the Textus Receptus. Now, there are Reformed Christian men today promoting the idea we should just go back to the TR. Forget all those new manuscripts. Forget all that stuff. If it was used by the Reformers, it's good enough for us. I find that dangerous and silly, but it's out there. And they're still my brothers, but I find it to be just a massive step backwards, especially at a time when we've been given so much more information than any other generation has ever had, at the very time that we have more attacks against the New Testament than we've ever had. Going back to that time period, I think, is very, very foolish, but that's what's going on. So what are the two biggest variants in the New Testament? Everybody, every Christian should know that there are two major variants. I cannot tell you how many times I have seen someone like a Bart Ehrman or his many, 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 many disciples, sometimes many generations removed, but his disciples, use this type of information to cause people to question the New Testament. The first one most people know about is the longer ending of Mark. Mark 16, 9 through 20. That's 12 verses long. That is a block of text. You not only have what's called the longer ending of Mark, you've got the medium ending of Mark, you've got a mixed ending of Mark, and you have the short ending of Mark, which just simply ends at verse 8. I wrote a book a number of years ago. It was mentioned before, the King James on the controversy. I talk about it there. There are entire books printed. People give different perspectives on the longer ending of Mark and all the rest of that stuff. But you need to know why those brackets are around it, and you need to know that that is a textual variant, especially if someone's trying to convince you to go handle poisonous snakes. Very good to know that that's actually a textual variant and probably not original with Mark. So not a good idea to do that. Been trying to get that information down south, Arkansas, places like that, but that could actually save lives. Really, really good to get folks to understand that. But the other major variant is the story of the woman taken in adultery. And it's everybody's favorite story. That's wood. That's good. Okay. Thank you. Okay. No, it's true. It ends up in every movie. Mel Gibson managed to cram it into The Passion of the Christ that had nothing to do with it at all. It's everywhere, and everybody loves it, and I get it. And that's probably why it ended up in the New Testament as it is. The reality is the first manuscript that we have that contains the story is the most unreliable manuscript of the early church, called Codex Beza Cantabrigiensis. When it was first donated and given to Theodore Beza, when he donated it to Cambridge University, he did so with a letter that said, "This manuscript is better to be stored than to be studied." It is the living Bible of the early church. It has all sorts of weird variants in it. The author was not trying to make a copy. He was trying to make a commentary. And it's the first and earliest manuscript. It's a Latin Greek diglot, by the way. It's both languages. But it's the first manuscript that contains that particular story. And that's in the 5th century. So the early 400s is the first time that there's any evidence of that. There's much earlier evidence of the long reigning of Mark than there is of the story of the woman taken in adultery. And the most important thing to me is that the story of the woman taken in adultery is not only found in 3 different places in the Gospel of John in certain manuscripts, but it's found in the Gospel of Luke in others. So when you have a story that pops up at different places, and it's the only story like that, there's nothing else like it, this is absolutely unique, that's clearly a story that a lot of people liked, that a lot of people even today will say, well, it's dominical in origin, which means it probably went back to the Lord, but we don't know that. And the reality is, and I will argue this one rather strenuously, our ultimate goal, our ultimate desire should be, I want to know what John wrote. Not what later generations thought would be neat that he would write or anything else. I want to know what John wrote. And if you have that as your ultimate criterion, that's a very, very good thing. Now, one other verse that I want to throw out there that has its own name is called the Comma Johannium. It is 1 John 5:7 in the King James Version of the Bible and in the New King James Version of the Bible. I remember the first time that I ever encountered a Mormon. I was a junior in high school, so please forgive me. And all we did on that outreach visit was argue about 1 John 5:7, which means we completely wasted the entirety of that evening. And I just didn't know better. I hadn't started my Greek studies at this particular in high school. But I have been told by many people, I've lost track of how many people have informed me that I'm going to hell because I don't believe 1 John 5:7 in the King James Version of the Bible is original, that it's absolutely vital. So in other words, there are a lot of people who believe that verse determines the gospel. How you understand it, that determines whether you're a Christian or not. Anyone remember the Jack Chick comic book tracks and things like that? Remember Jack Chick? And he had a series of comic books called Alberto, which were about Roman Catholicism, and this guy was a former Roman Catholic priest, and you know, there was filled with conspiracy theories and all sorts of stuff. I met Alberto once. He was speaking in Phoenix, ironically, at a non-Trinitarian Apostolic Oneness Church. I don't understand that, but anyways, that's where he was, and he was about yay big, I would say. I mean, I'm not overly tall, but he was not tall at all. And when I went in to meet, he asked what Bible I was carrying, and I had a New American Standard, and so he informed me that I was going to hell because it did not have 1 John 5:7 in it. And so that's not the first time people have done that, but it is, when it talks about there are 3 that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, these 3 are one. Again, it'd be wonderful if it was original. But here's the fact. If that's the original reading of 1 John, then we have no confidence about any of the rest of the New Testament. Because the fact of the matter is, it does not appear in any Greek manuscript of 1 John until the 14th century. So the funny thing is, I think a lot of modern Christians, they don't really care too much about the early church. And whether they read something in a certain way or not doesn't really matter to most people today. It matters to me. And the fact is, Christians for over 1,000 years had never read that in their version of 1 John. And so to make that the standard of the gospel is just amazingly silly to me. And yet they're, go online, go to YouTube, that fountain of all theological knowledge, and you'll be able to find, lots of folks explaining to you why that is the case. Now, very importantly, and we're almost out of time, but very importantly, every time I go to South Africa and I speak in one of the townships, which is some of the very, very, very depressed areas where people live in huts that are made out of corrugated steel and the roofs are held on by tires and very, very depressed areas. Every time I speak in those areas, you know the one subject that they ask me to address? Jehovah's Witnesses. Jehovah's Witnesses. Because there are witnesses on every street corner in those places. And they need information. They need to know. There are key texts relevant to Jehovah's Witnesses and to the deity of Christ that you might want to be aware of. For example, in John chapter 1, verse 18, John chapter 1, verse 18, the King James there, and that's the prologue of John, those first 18 verses, are meant to be taken as a whole, and they are bookended. So what John says in the first two verses, he then repeats in verse 18. It makes it a whole. And verse 18, he says, no one has seen God any time. And then you have two readings, homonogenes theos or homonogenes huios. The King James, New King James says, the only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has made him known. But the New American Standard, ESV, NIV, CSB, modern translations say the unique God or he who is God himself or the Son who is God, something along those lines. It'll use the word God. He is in the bosom of the Father or he is in close, intimate relationship with the Father and he has made him known. So is it Son or is it God? Well, the majority of manuscripts, later manuscripts, say Son. But the two earliest unsealed manuscripts, the great manuscripts that were discovered in the, they were known. One of them was known even to Erasmus. He wished he could have used it. And then the Codex Sinaiticus that was discovered in the 19th century, they both say God. Then when the papyri discovered only 90 years ago. When the papyri were discovered, to go even earlier, the two earliest copies we have that contain the beginning of the Gospel of John. And remember, for most books, the beginning and the end were the ones that's where the damage would be. Because if you have a little book, where's the damage often going to be? It's not going to be in the middle of the book. It's going to be the beginning and the end. And so having the beginning or the end of a book is a nice thing. The two earliest that we have, P66 and P75, both say God. So the four earliest manuscripts we have of the Gospel of John all agree in saying God, not Son. And so the evidence that has been provided to us, that kind of manuscript evidence, unfortunately, most of our New Testaments will just simply say, we'll make judgments like the earliest manuscripts say or the best manuscripts say, but you don't know which one of those manuscripts there are. Years ago, it's still available, I did about a 3.5-hour edition of The Dividing Line where I went through how to use critical editions of the Greek New Testament for yourself, that you can look up the manuscripts and know what the manuscripts, where they're kept, how old they are, you know, that type of stuff. And so that information is available. And in comparison to, you know, we spend a lot of time learning to do a lot of complex stuff in our lives that's going to have zero impact on eternity. It would be, I encourage people. For example, Philip Comfort's commentary on the Greek New Testament, the textual variations of the Greek New Testament, very, very useful. But, as I'm pretty much out of time, let me give you one warning. I've told you before, we're in the middle of a revolution right now. It's not a shooting revolution. It's not a bad revolution. It's the application of what I'm showing you here. And what that means is pretty much everything that was written before 2014 will be considered completely outdated, and really is already considered completely outdated by those doing the work, but will be considered completely outdated in a very short period of time. If someone were to ask me, do you know of a introduction to textual criticism right now that is currently up to date with everything we have? And I'd have to say, no, not right now. And they're supposed to be done with this application of CBGM to all the manuscripts by 2030. They have funding to finish up what's called the ECM by 2030. So we're in the middle of a revolution, and some people go, see, that's terrible. And I just simply go, no, it's not. But it takes time to do this, to do it right. And a lot of people are just impatient. I don't want a New Testament that changes. I want to know what Paul wrote. I want to know what John wrote. And if this can give me even greater assurance of that, then I want it. And it's just really short-sighted on the part of a lot of folks to basically go, wow, there's never been a time in church history where we've had access to more manuscripts of the New Testament, more knowledge of the writings of the early fathers that represent portions of the New Testament, more information about the Old Testament than we have today. But then to get upset about that, because that means there needs to be study done, and study doesn't get done overnight. It takes time. And it's really concerning me that a lot of my Reformed brethren are saying, see, we don't want any of that. We can just simply go back to what the Reformers had. I don't think the Reformers would have agreed with that. I can guarantee you Erasmus and Stephanus and Beza would have scoffed at such an idea. But it has a certain appeal to certain people. I don't want to have notes. Well, guess who else doesn't have notes in their sacred text? The Muslims. Muslims don't have any notes in their sacred text. That Arabic copy of the Quran that all of them read, it's the exact same printing, 1924 Egyptian edition. There are no textual notes in that. There are variants in the text of the Quran, but you're not going to get it from that. And Muslims will say, see, we have a unified text. And it bugs me when I have Christians hold up the TR and go, see, we have a unified text. And it's like, you're all missing it on the exact same level. And it should not be the case. That just should not be something that is going on. So that's a lot of stuff in a very short period of time. We have done debates on these issues. We've done debates with Muslims on these issues. I've debated Adnan Rashid. I've debated Yusuf Ismail on these things. One in London, one in South Africa. So there's stuff that you can go and look at. I've given my full presentation a number of times, which is available online, where I show the manuscripts and we look at P75 and all the stories related to that. Do that very, very often. But we're covering a lot wider range of things in the time period that we have here. And so what's the most important thing? Widest attestation, earliest attestation. CBGM has now given us absolutely computer-generated documentation that the idea that the New Testament has been altered or changed in its fundamental form, in its teaching, in its doctrine, is impossible. You would have to theorize that all the original lines of transmission somehow were beamed up to the Enterprise. And there might be some people who might have to go that far. I've met some atheists that are going, yeah, Spock got them. Yeah, sure, you bet. There's simply no other way to try to defend that idea that there has been insertion of doctrine, insertion of teaching. It just simply is not possible, and we can demonstrate that. So, with that, what are we supposed to do next? I'm supposed to get out of the way and let you talk.
We're going to take a 10-minute break, and then Dr. White will be back up, and we'll do some questions. So,
okay, cool.
Take a break. Thank you.